off my bar, pawb. Good evening, everyone. So yeah, my name's David Phillips. I'm an associate director at the IFS, and I now lead our work on tax in developing countries, but for kind of many years I did work on inequality and poverty and work on tax in the UK. And you know, the topic of tonight's conversation is universal basic income. It's an idea that recently has come to the fore again over the last few years. Switzerland had a referendum in 2016 on whether to introduce a national universal basic income scheme of 2,200 Swiss francs a month, quite a high level in Switzerland. Finland has been trialling UBI for groups of people initially unemployed. And the Scottish government has discussed trialling UBI as well and been assured that it's in that kind of Labour leader candidates' manifestos or discussions. The actual kind of national scheme that has been put in place, Iran. Iran scrapped its system of subsidies for fuel and food and water and introduced a UBI in 2011. But UBI, while in vogue, is actually an old idea. Between 1968 and 1982, a series of trials in the US looked at the impact of giving everyone a fixed sum of money, irrespective of their circumstances, and then tapering it away as their income increased from things like earnings, savings, and pensions. That wasn't called UBI then, it was called income maintenance or negative income tax. But it was basically UBI. So why the interest again after more than 30 years? As was said by Claire, perhaps it's concerns about a benefit system that some people think has become too stringent and uncaring, putting claimants through too many hoops. Perhaps it's concerns about the changing labour market and the prospect of a new wave of automation, putting millions of people out of work. And I think we'll hear some of these arguments from our two speakers arguing in favour of the UBI. But the argument, the idea also has many detractors as well. Those who say it'll be too costly or mean taking money off needy groups that currently receive substantial amounts of benefits, that it would discourage work, and that there's no evidence yet, at least, of a decline in work for people. And UBI is yet to be implemented on a wide scale anywhere outside of Iran, where actually it's been seen very much as a replacement for costly subsidies rather than actually a true UBI in the sense we talk about in the UK. So with all this in mind, I would like to hand you over to our speakers. On the pro side, arguing in favour of UBI, we've got Professor Calvin Harris and Mark Hooper. Calvin is the Professor of Economics and Deputy Dean for Public Values and Student Relations at Cardiff University. And Mark is founder of IndyCube, a community benefit society and cooperative that runs co-working spaces in Wales, and I think some parts of England now as well. Speaking against UBI will be Anna Coote, who's a principal fellow at the New Economics Foundation and a leading analyst and writer in the field of social policy, and Polly McKenzie, chief executive of Demos, a cross-party think tank. So, how we're going to do this is we're going to have one person speak for and one person against, and hopefully that will kind of spark a bit of debate in the initial discussion. And if you can each speak for kind of 3, perhaps 4 minutes at most, and then we'll hopefully have time for like a big, long debate after that. So first I'll hand over to Calvin Jones.
Thanks, Steve. I feel like a little bit of imposter here because I think we're a long way from the idea that a UBI is implementable tomorrow and will somehow solve wages of the political or social problems. But I think what I would be arguing for is that we need to think seriously about what a UBI would look like for Wales and how we might at least investigate to kick the tires in real terms rather than just in debating terms to see where this idea has got any legs. I mean, there are a couple of reasons for this. I mean, obviously Dave's already kind of highlighted the one which is the most topical, which is that you know, we do face a new wave of automation based around machines of various types which can replicate human activities across an ever wider scope. potentially cheaper and better. I just say potentially at the moment. I don't want to live in a world filled with tens of thousands of unemployed paralegals and junior audit accountants. That terrifies me. But bad enough when they're locked up in their offices. Letting them out on the streets, you know, is something that we should take lightly. But I mean, the serious point is that we, you know, so communities that I lived in lived through the economic dislocation of the 1980s, and many people with what were then high value jobs were told that the market had spoken, that there was no longer a role for heavy industries and light industries, along with coal mines, steel works, and so on. And that retraining would be a route to a prosperous future. That was true for a minority of them, but in most cases the quality of work diminished, and in most cases the quality of lives diminished. And we face societies in both the rural and the urban parts of the world which have not recovered from economic dislocation, which now face another wave of even more stark economic dislocation. And it seems to me that now is the time that we need to face up to the fact that we cannot create, under the largely laissez-faire system we have in the UK and the EU, enough, inverted commas, high-quality jobs to keep people out of poverty at the bottom end of the income scale, whether that's because of skills issues, engagement issues, if you like, to do with the ability to work because of long-standing kind of issues around health or mental well-being. It's time to stop pretending that work is a panacea for social ills. And it's also time to stop pretending that work is somehow worthy. You know, I have kind of arguments with some of my friends on the left, particularly in unions, who argue for the dignity of work, that the working class finds its voice through work, hence the name. Voluntary exchange of time and effort for money, wage labour, is only 500 years old. Over a civilization span of 10,000 years. There's a strong argument that if AI automation turns out the way that we think it might, that those days are gone, or are at least becoming diminished over time in terms of the scope of the population they apply to. And it will not hurt us to investigate what else you might do to distribute resources around society other than basing it notionally and not even in reality on the exchange of labour for money.
Okay, great. Anna, I wondered if... Oh, sorry, no, you're right.
I don't mind.
It was Polly I said to come next. Polly, I wonder if you wanted to kind of come back on some of those points or maybe kind of give your thoughts on why you think that UBI is not practical, but actually... If it's an idea worth considering, maybe not considering for very long.
So who's seen the film Wall-E, about a little robot? Few people. Okay, so basically the planet's been destroyed by, you know, the sort of the grotesque consumption of, you know, I don't know, probably the next 50 years, perhaps the next 500, who knows? Who knows exactly when it's set? There's this little robot trundling around trying to clear up the world. And anyway, he goes up to this spaceship in the sky where people have been evacuated to the spaceship. And they basically zoom around in these little kind of floating wheelchairs with adverts and screens in front of them the whole time. And we hear this kind of narrative from the left about the future in a sort of post-AI world where the robots will run everything. And we'll have leisure time and freedom and resources. And the image that comes back to me is of these obese, incapable people fixated on screens, zooming around in a spaceship above a destroyed world that we see in Wall-E. And that, to me, is, what do they call it, automated luxury communism. There's a thing that somebody, he's called Aaron Bastani, weirdly enough, a long time ago, under a different name, he interned at Demos when he was still a liberal. And I hesitate because I totally understand that those who advocate for universal basic income are motivated primarily by a desire, which is completely right, to end poverty. And I think that's a desire that ought to motivate all of us, particularly, you know, as the UN rapporteur explored, this sense that in a developed country like ours, that we still tolerate these extraordinary quantities of poverty, that is grotesque and it does need to be addressed. But I mostly want to talk about politics, and I'm very aware that having spent basically 15 years working in politics, I am, among this esteemed audience, at risk of opening myself up to attacks of being a sort of callous populist who thinks, I may even use the word handouts, which I've been criticised for before. But I think that the welfare state is an act of solidarity which requires, above all, consent and willingness to participate in that solidarity. The welfare state is people who have voluntarily giving money away to those who have faced unlucky circumstances. And that may be because they think it might happen to them, but it also might be because they have generosity and compassion in their hearts and they want to give... They want to give money, and the problem is, right, that most people want to give money to people who are like them, and they want to trust people. And that sense of giving away money for free with no conditionality does not have the ability to capture popular support in any way that is sustainable. Support for the welfare state has been collapsing since the 1970s. When I worked in government, George Osborne cut billions and billions from the welfare state, and feel free to criticise me for being complicit in that. But the fundamental thing is he got away with it politically because everyone said, yeah, do you know what? The state is too generous to all these feckless scroungers. You start giving out money unconditionally, the idea that you'll be able to make the case for generosity in an unconditional system is completely for the birds. We are here tonight under, they haven't got a banner, but Wales in London, who sponsored me to do work experience when I was 17 in London. Right? Wales in, I don't know who the fundraisers are for it, right? But you give money to Wales in London because you believe in helping other people who are Welsh, right? This is an act of solidarity based on a sense of shared identity. And that's right at the heart of giving, is a sense that you believe in the people to whom you are giving money. And unconditionality cannot sustain a generous system. It never, ever will.
Thanks. Polly. So, Mark, I wonder if you have any thoughts on that, or, you know...
I don't know where to start, really, but...
Yeah, but also, you know, kind of issues around, you know, automation and other things like that. So, you know, do we need a new system? Does it need to be universal because we need to have a system that can kind of cope with massive changes coming forwards? Or do we need to pay serious attention to issues around conditionality and things like that? Or is that system, you know, out of date now?
So, let's start. So Wales is about to hit 40% child poverty. So when we have the special raconteur for poverty coming to Wales and other places and saying that this system is no longer working for people, I think we should take notice and we should start to think about what we do about it rather than let that continue in the way that it is. And whether we need to feel solidarity with people, the one thing that I would say is I think it is the human condition should make sure that nobody in the fifth richest economy in the world suffers from poverty in the way that we're seeing it. We're seeing people in a situation where it just doesn't work. And one of the issues with that is that work no longer works. You know, we've got JRF did their review of poverty in Wales recently and published it. The fastest growing cohort of people in poverty in Wales have two people working in that household. The second fastest growing have one person working in the household. And the slowest growing, but the biggest amount of people with nobody working in the household. So the one thing that's clear is that work no longer works. So we're not talking about automation. I think automation and things like that are things that are coming down the line. But today, this isn't working for Wales, and we've got people in poverty. And it's not just it's relative poverty. We have people in abject poverty to the point where we're getting people who are committing suicide because they can no longer see that. So we are killing people with the way that it's working. So we have an issue that we need to solve. Then we have a benefit system that adds woes to that system, and it encourages people and makes people think work is the answer to their problems. But we already know that it's not. So we're forcing people into a situation where work is their only way, or at least a pursuit of work is their only way to be able to get access to these funds. And the thing that really disturbs me in all this is that we have enough. So not only are we the fifth richest economy, but even in Wales, which is often considered income poor, it's actually about, it has about the median wealth of the whole of the UK. So it's not as though we're poor, we just have our wealth locked up in assets that are untaxed. So land, for example, is something we don't tax. It appreciates in value, as most people look at their house prices and think, great, I'm getting richer because my house is getting richer, doesn't get taxed. We have enough, we just choose, and it is a political choice not to do anything about it. If the political choice is 40% of our children living in poverty, I think that's a poor choice, and I think people like Osborne didn't get away with it, because some of us remember it well. The problem is that people have no alternatives to deal with these things. But the issues of automation then come back to this is a worldwide issue that we're needing to resolve. If we're serious about it, and Wales wants to play its part in the international community, we need to do our own bit to look at these issues. We need to go up to our own bit to test universal basic income. I work with people who are self-employed. 77% of self-employed people live in poverty. Now that's a statistic that shocked me, even though I worked in, but it didn't surprise me. If that's a situation that we want to resolve, what I would do is look at a cohort of self-employed people and test it on them and just try and find out what the behaviour changes are. Will they all become feckless scroungers, or will what they actually become people who contribute more to society than before? And the thing that frustrates, and this is the last point, is that one of the things that the current situation does, it actually undervalues a lot of work that goes on that just doesn't get paid. If child rearing is considered value work, that should be considered in the same way as people who work in offices. At the moment, we put the people who earn the most in this world fritter our money away in investment banks. The people who earn least in our world are picking up the crap that we leave behind them. And these are the situations, the issues that I think we need to resolve. So I think we need to be there, we need to be at the table, and we need to test it.
Thanks. So, Anna, just had a case that, you know, we need to test this idea. We need a trial for this idea to see whether it has any legs. Do you agree with that, or do you think that would just be a distraction from the real problems you face and that this idea doesn't have any legs?
No, I think it would be a real distraction. The reason is, I mean, this thing about the trials that you mentioned, the Swiss referendum said no, resoundingly. The Finland trial has been cut off after 2 years. It's not going to be... I didn't interrupt you. Permission was asked to extend the trial. It's only a trial of giving... a basic income to a selected group of people, i.e. people who are unemployed, so it's not a universal basic income. The point I want to make about, and the Scottish thing hasn't happened yet, and there's all this talk about trials as though it was actually happening. Now, I've spent the last few months going through all these trials and finding out what they add up to, and they really don't add up to a row of beans. They are almost invariably selective. They've been short-term, not all of them, but they've been, except the Alaska Fund is different, but that's a tiny amount of money, which is an entirely different model. So the first thing you've got to understand about universal basic income is that it means different things to different people, and it can mean almost anything to anybody. It has almost infinite number of meanings and variations. So the question for Wales is, if you are going to trial something, what are you going to trial? Are you going to trial a kind of social security reform that would be more generous than the one we have now? Okay, that's fine. But don't call it universal basic income. And what you have to think about is, if you're going to give a sufficient amount of money without condition to everybody in Wales, it will suck up all the money, all the public funds that you can possibly imagine you would ever have. So you wouldn't be able to put more money into local services. You wouldn't be able to put more money into anything else. And in fact, your electorate wouldn't stand it anyway. Those are the only decent piece of really forensic analysis of what UBI adds up to has been carried out by a team at Bath University, the guy called Luke Martinelli. Everybody must read that report. And his conclusion, and he went back to the figures two or three times, was that an adequate UBI would be unaffordable, and an affordable UBI would be inadequate. So don't think about constructing a whole new model that is not going to give people enough money, because you're creating a great machinery to pull along a little vehicle that won't help people enough. And what my plea, and you must also think about, so think about trade-offs. Are there, if you're going to pay for UBI, what are you not going to pay for? And think about the, if you were going to have UBI and somehow magically found the money to give a basic income, a reasonable basic income, to everybody in Wales, think about the power that you would give to the government who would be giving this money. Now, I'm not against government, but I do not like the idea of a single, huge, powerful lever in the hands of the state that can give and can then take away. So that's just my opening. I think, yes, I agree with the desire to have to do something. People are desperate for radical change, but this is not the answer. And it's been marketed by its advocates as a sort of silver bullet, but what works in India and Kenya won't work in Wales. Actually, it doesn't work as universal basic income in either India or Kenya, but I haven't got time to explain why.
Okay, thanks, Anna. So I'll now kind of pose some questions to the different sides, to get some debate going, and then after we've kind of had a discussion, we'll come to the audience for kind of questions. So I wanted to come back to the kind of the pro side first of all, and follow up on that kind of one of the kind of comments there that Anna made around cost and generosity. So, introducing UBI would either mean raising tens of billions of pounds more money, even more than that, £100 billion more of revenue, or taking money off those that currently get relatively large amounts of benefits, like the elderly, like the disabled, like people living in London, areas with high housing costs. So, what is your solution to that quandary? Is this about actually, changing who we give money to, or is it actually about getting more money in? And if it's about getting more money in, how can we do that?
Well, I mean, the idea that you can't raise more money at a time when we've slashed corporation tax in the UK significantly, at a time when we know that we lose minimum of £50 billion in tax avoidance every year, seems very defeatist place to start. I think, absolutely, we are in a way we can increase taxes, particularly on assets, and particularly in the richer part of the country, which would release a significant amount of money. And I don't think that there's any suggestion, for example, that the state pension somehow doesn't work because everybody gets it, or that the fuel allowance should be withdrawn because everybody gets it, and there's no social contract whereby we're allowed to give over the money because everyone revolts in the streets. So we already have universal benefits in the UK, which have been in place for decades, and which nobody seems at all bothered about, despite the fact that many people get them are very well off.
So you have to have 35 years of national insurance contributions of one form or another in order to be entitled to
it. But the link between national insurance...
For the pension, it's not linked to anything else. It's linked to the pension. It's not universal, the pension. You move to the country at 62, you don't get a pension.
No, yeah, that's true, but
that's why I don't... So you're just saying something that's not true.
Not means-tested benefits, then.
No, indeed, not means-tested, but not universal. It's entitlement-based.
Okay, it's entitlement-based. So,
although pension credit on that, right? So pension credit is as generous as the state pension, and that's means-tested, but it's not entitlement. So there's a combination of things which effectively means it is universal. Either you get it as a contribution or you get it means-tested. There's a very, very, very small proportion of the population that get nothing, especially with all the things you get entitlements for nowadays. So is that the point you were making?
The point I'm making is half the welfare state was kept for people. And that is, that seems to be socially high, even though in terms of need, there's a huge mismatch there between who gets what. Anna's point seems to be that because we haven't tried it properly, we know it doesn't work. I'm not unsure what Anna's arguing. Either UBI has been tried and found to fail, or we haven't tried it properly. One of the two. Now, I absolutely take that. You cannot jump to a universal basic income and somehow find tens of billions and play it somewhere and expect you to have not that they do work first time out, there might have huge amounts of unintended consequences. But I think if you had either a segment of the population whereby you tried it, or you had an area-based policy where you tried it somewhere, then you could investigate what it did in terms of people's well-being and understand how that might.
So Mark, I wonder what your kind of view on this issue of cost is, Mark, because I've got some kind of follow-up questions around the issue of cost and on the issue of like kind of trialness. So do you have any thoughts on, is this about, spending what we currently spend differently, or do you think this is about getting more revenue in from the people and actually making the system more generous?
So two things. I think we need to trial something, so I think we need to learn. I think that talking in a vacuum about things not working, as Calvin just said, I think is not the right way of doing it. In terms of the cost of this, then I don't think that this cannot just sit in isolation. It isn't just changing the block grant we get from Westminster and spending it in a different way. This is about redistributing our money in such a way that our economy works. At the moment, the economy sitting there is a construct that doesn't work for people. And the consequences of doing that end up in the sort of social upheaval we're seeing as a result of Brexit. So when we look at these, why do we've got, apologise if anyone voted UKIP in this room at the minute. The Welsh Assembly had 7 UKIP members at the last Assembly election. And for me, I think that says something about the complete failure of social democracy to deliver an economy that works for people. If that's where we're going, then that worries me a lot. And it worries me a lot in Wales because we've been there. Calvin mentioned at the start, we've got communities that have been cast adrift for 30 or 40 years. This is just going to get deeper. We work in a lot of those communities. And, the hope there is effectively gone. Now, unless we start to so this is a rebuilding of the social construct. I think it's a rebuilding of the economy.
Okay, so I'll ask two more questions of you guys, and I'll come across to give you a grilling as well. So my kind of question is, you've talked a bit about, the impression I get from you is saying that, look, we need to actually have a new social contract, we need to redistribute more, we need to actually, get extra revenues in so that we can...
I think the challenge should be, it's not that, that isn't the question.
Okay.
The question is, should we, as a country, so we're talking about Wales here, do we accept 40% child poverty? If that's an acceptable position, then it's not my position. How do we solve those issues? Because at the moment, the way we're solving it isn't working. And that's why we need different ways of thinking. So this is part of the answer. I don't think it's a panacea at all. And I don't think anyone would suggest it, but that's the challenge.
Well, I want to come back to this kind of question of cost. I think it's an important issue. I'm not saying that I think that a child poverty rate of 40% is a good thing or not. But on the issue of cost, we already know that over the next 30 years or so, across the UK as a whole, we're going to have to raise like £100 billion of extra tax in today's prices just to pay for pensions, health, and social care. Before we start even making the system more generous, if you want to tackle child poverty, we could have a system where we actually try to tackle that in a more targeted way. How do you think, you're already seeing the government struggle, we had a budget where the government trailed the idea of tax rises. It said you might need to raise taxes to fund the NHS. And yet it kind of copped out when the kind of figures come in a little bit more rosy in terms of the public finances. Mm-hmm. We see things like council tax revaluations be incredibly unpopular, even when they're revenue neutral, let alone trying to get more money from council tax. How can you build the case? How do you think politically you can say, look, we're going to actually, not only raise 100 billion, we're going to raise 150 billion or 200 billion to make this system?
That is the biggest challenge, and the reason it's the biggest challenge is because you've got a population in the UK who is drowning in luxury and thinks they're poor, and has been taught over the last 50 years, 60 years, to think that their well-being relies on these things, and on Netflix and on. And as long as you have an economy which is based on consumption of material goods as a way of living well-being, you cannot have the universal basic income that works. So there is, as Martha said, there is a number of, and I got the job, talk last Friday I was giving, and one of the candidates, the leading candidate for the Welsh Labour job kind of came in, the next First Minister probably, just as I was castigating the Welsh Government for not having original thought in his body on the economy in 20 years, which is great timing. He missed all my great slides because we came in just as I was saying that. We we have not tried anything different in Wales or indeed in the UK since the mid-80s in terms of how we organise our economy. I suspect that whatever we do in terms of the way that we organise economic production, distribution, consumption has to respect ecological planetary limits, and it's not 500 years that Wally would be wandering around in 50. We need some way of reorganising the way we distribute resources in order to fit with 1.5 degrees of CB, which is we're nowhere near. We're talking about the fact of the end of capitalism or the end of the world, one of the two. There is no such thing as eco-capitalism. And if, as I believe, we are in that space, then UBI is one of a number of things that we might be trying, including stringent carbon taxes, including helping people work where they live and not have to travel however many miles you guys who live in London have to travel all the time to get to work. There's a variety of things, and UBI might be one thing that we try and discard. But you know what? If you throw enough stuff at the wall, something's going to stick. And I don't think at this stage we can start to rule things out when they haven't been fully trialed on the basis that they might be too expensive. Because expensive in the context of what? A burning planet or 40% child poverty? We already are the obese people wandering around looking at screens all day. That's already here. We're on the spaceship. So UBI is about starting a conversation which says to people, okay, there's a new social contract which requires you to engage. And that's where I think the universal bit is slightly problematic. You could put money for nothing. I would much favour something which says, there's money here, you can have the money, but we are going to develop over years a relationship with you as a set of governments or whatever it is, public authorities, that will help you have a better life through engaging your communities in a number of ways. And in return, this is the money that you will get, which will free you from the burden of requiring 40 hours of your time in a bullshit job. And that's my vision for UBI. It's not where we are now, and I'm not suggesting that we get in 5 years.
Okay. So I want to kind of turn to these guys over here and kind of, first of all, you know, when you come back, happy to hear your kind of thoughts on the point you just made. I also wanted to kind of raise two kind of additional questions here. So I was going to ask this question to the pro side first of all, but I can ask it to the anti side as well. So there actually have been some kind of large scale trials of this in communities that were kind of
name one.
So in the 1960s and 70s there were kind of trials in Canada, in Indiana, in Colorado, in Pennsylvania, in Washington State.
That was half a century ago.
Yeah. So I want to come back to it. It was a while ago, but what they kind of found is that they found that there were people did cut back on how much they worked. So the average man cut back their hours of work by about 7%. The average woman cut their hours by about 16%. That's not the same as people becoming, you know, completely bone idle and lazy and just doing nothing.
You work at the IFS, right? So I don't have the tax benefit model that you do. But you tell me what a 7% male reduction and a 16% female reduction in hours worked would do to GDP and to tax revenue. Because I can tell you this, it would take that 100 billion tax gap you just talked about it, and it would make it very, very substantially larger.
Not true. My organisation, we run a four-day week, have done for the last 2 years, where we're trying to find out whether we can be as productive in 4 days as we were in five. So I think that as a challenge is something most people take everyone's daily work. You know, they don't sit around, they're not productive for a majority of their time. There's a lot of unproductive.
That's the difference. You're talking about a shorter working week, which I'm entirely in favour of. And it doesn't need to go hand in hand with
EBI. If we reduce our working hours by 70%, we take a load of value out of the economy.
What this thing does about the reduction in time, which I think is actually not a very important argument for this, I must say,
but it
runs the danger of locking women into domestic roles, because women are certainly, and there is some evidence from some of those trials, that women tend to take more time off.
Women reduce it by more than men.
So you get this is a sort of wages for housework arguments we used to have back in the 70s. Say, well, hang on a minute. Yes, of course we value female work and unpaid work in the home, but we do not want to start giving women a wage, because it'll just simply calcify gender inequalities as they are now. So women will stay at home, get a small amount of basic income. Men will go out and do the work and be, it's just not a way.
Yeah, we already have a system whereby of all of the wages taken home in the UK, 2/3 of them go to men and only 1/3 of women go to women. We talk about a gender pay gap of 19%. In fact, the wages gap is that men earn twice what women earn. And if you have a universal basic income that pushes women to default to being the one who takes on those unpaid responsibilities in return for what, £3 or something, then
we
back on something else that was said earlier. I completely agree that it's possible to raise more money.
Yeah.
Totally. Nobody would disagree with that. Of course we can raise more money. Any government can raise more money. We can do tax avoidance, we can have more tax, we can have do quantitative easing. There's any number of ways that we can raise more money. However, if you can raise more money, what do you want to spend it on? Now, I would just suggest that we will get, and in fact there is some real evidence for this, get much better value for money out of investing in services and the local economy, so that it begins, so you get things like better public transport, you get better childcare, you get better adult social care, you get better housing. All these are things that have a multiplier effect, but just giving people money does not. And it's a collective, hang on, let me finish. It's a collective responsibility. It's a collective model, whereas if you're universal basic income, it's individual, it's monetized, it's basically, that's why all those moguls in Silicon Valley love the idea, because they think, yeah, let's just get rid of the state, let's just give people money so that they've just got enough money to keep on shopping while we can carry on making ourselves richer and richer. It does nothing for poverty, it does nothing for inequality, it's a waste of money. What causes poverty?
Well, it's a lack of money, isn't it?
Yeah, yes, but come on, it's not that simple. You need a. That's why this idea of universal basic income is so dangerous, because it seems to be a simple answer to a very complicated problem.
Can I just very quickly? As I found myself agreeing with like 90% of what Mark was saying about tackling poverty, about rethinking the way that we look after each other and we look after children. And that's mostly because he almost never mentioned universal basic income. He just talked about the fact that we absolutely, categorically must do something differently. But you cannot make a case that that something is universal basic income, especially on the basis of what we're saying about trials are never about universality. They're usually about unconditional, either unconditional wage supplements, which we have, they're means tested, but they are largely unconditional, or unconditional benefits. And I think we have to remind ourselves why we also think that unconditional benefits sometimes are a bad thing, because they are often about writing people off because it is the cheapest thing to do. If you have somebody with a long-term mental health condition, a long-term alcohol dependency problem, the cheapest thing to do is give them a small amount of money and rent a flat for them and leave them alone and let them die. And the Treasury will tell you that that is the cheapest thing to do. And the expensive thing to do is find ways to engage with them, to get them out of the house, to find a way to retrain them, to help them deal with their dependency problems. And you will not always succeed. In fact, oftentimes you will spend a lot of money failing. But writing people off and leaving them alone does not work.
So look, I want to come back on this kind of point I raised. So I didn't raise this point about there being trials, you know, just kind of offhand. There have been trials. So there have been trials that do universal, you know, things, and there's been 6 or 7 in the United States. There are negative income tax experiments. Now, what they do is they show that UBI is always going to be taken, because you always need to pay for it. So you always need to pay for it somehow. So you kind of the idea behind the UBI is you give everyone £5,000, £10,000 a year, then you kind of have a taper rate of, you know, whether it's, you know, you can earn the first £5,000 tax free, and then you taper it away at 50%. You need a way to kind of pay for it somehow.
Yeah, but it's still amazing, though. Right, £10,000, though. £10,000. Right, so £10,000.
Hold on.
Who can live on £10,000? The minimum income standard for the JRF is like 19.
I know. But hold on. So in the United
States, you've got disability, you need to rent somewhere to live. I mean,
in the United States, they did studies on this about how much it would cost. You know, given the estimates of the labor response. And given what the federal poverty line is in the United States, and I can come back on that, they thought you could pay for this about 2% of GDP.
So you're talking about the New Jersey trial now?
No, I'm talking about
Are you talking about
this?
Because I have recently studied these trials,
so
and I saw that result.
So I'm talking
and
about
it was simply somebody's opinion.
I'm talking about the paper by well, Ashenfelter did a critique of it. So there's a paper there produced by the Boston thing.
I want you both to produce footnotes.
Oh, well, I've got them
so
actually here. I've got them
what I was going to say on this is that there has been some evidence that actually these things can be done, you know, for relatively low levels of poverty line at a relatively reasonable cost. So my question on you is, and please answer this, my question is your concern with that actually even that amount of kind of tax would be a, you know, not a feasible amount to increase revenues by, in that given we need to increase revenues for other areas, or do you think that this would be a bad use of those revenues? And if we did want to kind of raise additional revenues to support people that are, you know, doing badly in the labour market, that are currently in poverty, that there are better ways of doing it than the UPI?
Absolutely.
That's my question.
That is my whole point, is that you certainly can raise more money, but this is not the best way to do it. I mean, the other thing we need to do with our money is have good green infrastructure, because we do have one hell of a problem with the environment. And we do have to get our carbon GHG emissions down, and we do have to learn to live without the high levels of consumption. Now, that takes investment as well. I mean, a massive amount of investment. So I'd like to use the 2% GDP. If we could increase public funds by that amount, then I would like to use it on increasing the quality and the extent, the scope and the reach of the services we've got. And I'd like to invest in green infrastructure. And I think both of those things will create a lot of jobs. Okay? So I think that those are much better ways of tackling poverty and doing something about the economy, which I completely agree. Of course, we've got to do something about the economy.
But this is
sort of a simple neoliberal, you know, give money to individuals.
But there's one more point, right, which is that what you're talking about is incredibly low levels of the poverty line, right? That don't meet a minimum income standard. And
we're
that's
also talking about Wales,
about
which has a lower cost of living than the rest of the UK. So in Wales, we can some of this stuff. So you talk about £10,000 a year. So you have two adults taking £10,000 a year. You also have children. I would suggest that children
what
get,
if they're disabled?
They get extra benefits on top.
Okay, so you haven't abolished needs testing.
I didn't say I wasn't going to abolish needs testing.
But the most of the
needs testing.
No, so that's
see, this is what people say. That if you're going to do that, that's going to cost more money again. So yes, we will. Or if you're going to have just a little bit of UBI, then you've got to have a lot of top-up.
But what
benefits.
Society do we want
so
to live in?
What is the point of thinking about UBI, which is supposed to simplify everything? Well, it doesn't.
We printed $25 billion for the banks in 2008. We don't know about that, can we?
But why would you do it that way, though, when you could do it in a way that really did engender more solidarity, more collective action, get people, you know, having better services? I mean, I have worked in Wales, and we do a lot of work with communities who want to kind of improve the quality of their lives, and what they really are crying out for is they want a bus service, they want a community centre, they want better housing, and they, you know, so, and lots of other things, that they want childcare, they want adult social care, they need things that they can do together. And if you were to give them money instead, you'd only be able to give them a tiny bit of money. You get much better results, much more value for money if you invest in services.
Of course we should tax land. I mean, you know, Liberals have been arguing for that for, you know, 150 years at least. I mean, no, indeed. Because, you know, like, it's really hard to win political will for these things. It doesn't say we should give up on them. Of course not. But
we started a campaign yesterday. There's one thing we agree on. So
right, excellent. Well, I'm in favour of a carbon tax. I'm in favour of a land tax. Of course, we've got this £100 billion tax gap. You know, of course we need to transform the economy. Of course the current efforts to tackle poverty are completely unacceptable and insufficient. But the idea that a universal handout to every single member of the population, however you then create marginal higher tax rates later on. It's just a deeply inefficient way to spend money when you could be spending money on creating jobs, creating community infrastructure and services.
Actually know that to be true. So the issue is will people distribute that money more effectively? So if you give people in local communities, people are more like their money, they'll spend that money locally, which will then circulate more quickly, which will then create those virtual economies, the benefits we want to go and see. If we do that, the poorest people spend their money the quickest. They're also more likely, if they're given the chance, to spend that money more locally.
So here's a question I want to kind of ask. So, I mean, I'm not saying unless you agree with this, but the argument you've made is that we can spend our money more efficiently if we kind of invest it as a society. Well, we could also spend money more efficiently. You know, government could bulk buy food for people and get economies of scale by buying food for people. It could decide on people's spending money. We sometimes kind of think that people are good judges of what's in their own interest. So, you know, one solution, you know, could one solution be that actually we kind of get rid of a lot of what the kind of state currently does and say, actually, look, we're going to actually, you know, rather than pay for healthcare for you, rather than pay for education for you, what we're going to do is we're going to give you, you know, everyone gets the same amount of money that's, you know, spent on these kind of services. They can pay for insurance, they can pay for things themselves.
Would that be an option?
So a libertarian kind of case for universal basic income.
This is the most coherent argument for universal basic income, is basically give everyone a sort of cash dividend and then wring your hands and say, not my problem, Gov, you had a handout, you had a stuff, leave it all to the market. And so from the Silicon Valley kind of right-wing people, that sense that perhaps you might have a school system, maybe. And then once you've got 18, everyone's had a fair start, everyone's got enough money to not die, so who needs a welfare state, who needs support? That's a coherent intellectual argument. It's also complete. I was going to say rude words, so I shan't. You should know my politics at all, but the idea that what the state should do is just recycle money through a big system and like slosh it out to people. It's just a way to completely destroy solidarity, which is the thing that the left depends on most of all.
I mean, this is Charles Murray, who some of you may know is one of the kind of leading proponents of the libertarian right in the United States. Okay, and he says he doesn't like the, he's very much against the government paying out a huge amount of money on income transfers, which are means tested, he said, and on services and on all the other things that the state spends money on. He said, we should take all of that money and give it back to the American people in cash grants. That is the voice of the libertarian
right. I find it really disingenuous that's the attack that's coming to the side, because that's not what we're talking about. So
I know you're not. I'm not suggesting you are. I'm just saying it is very dangerous.
I think Calvin's similar.
Please don't think I'm accusing you of being like Charles Murray.
I'm not taking Charles Murray's point. I'm not taking the Silicon Valley tech entrepreneur's point. I'm taking another point, which is about how do we solve the problems that we've got in Wales. This is within a Welsh context, and this is something that we see in our communities are struggling to be able to make things work. And that solidarity that you're talking about is long. So we're talking about social, the social economy, the solidarity that is fast disappearing. So if you think that's working today, you need to come to some of the valley communities, because
no,
it isn't there.
No,
so the solidarity is lost. So we need to find another way. I also think that if you let people, give people the time to do the things they really want to do, we will be surprised by how much good they do. And this is the stuff that people are less worried about paying their mortgage bill and their rent bill. They'll do things that have got a value that are beyond the things that we think of at the moment.
Great. Well, look. I now open up to the audience for kind of questions. Before doing that, very quickly, I think I'll say where I think we've got to. So I think where we've got to is you've agreed there's a kind of a problem with the way the current system is working, whether that's kind of the current welfare system not doing enough to support low-income people in work poverty. We've also kind of, I think, agreed that overall there's potentially too much, you know, inequality, and that could be kind of affected by what's happening in the economy going forwards. I think where we haven't agreed at all is whether UBI is kind of a possible answer to that, whether it's something that's worth investigating further, or whether it's a kind of a big distraction and actually that it's not politically feasible, that it's actually going to be damaging in terms of our ability to actually tackle some of these problems, or whether, you know, radical problems need radical solutions, and that actually if we're thinking about the whole social contract going forwards, we need to be thinking radically. So, but those kind of, you know, agreeing on kind of is a problem, not agreeing on the solution. I wondered what people in the audience, any questions you had for particular panelists or for the panel as a whole. And if you could say who you are.
These are personal views, not connected with my work, should I say. Thank you. So, I find myself in a difficult position of agreeing with both of you, both sides, and I'm struggling with that, and I think it's partly because the question is really, what's the alternative? So if you say there should be no UBI, does that mean you're prepared to tolerate people living on less than that, and if that means starving to death or whatever, that's what happens to them? Once you say, no, actually, we're not prepared to tolerate that, then what's wrong with having a minimum that you say, well, everybody gets that? Now, I think there are lots of issues around that in terms of what is sufficiency and tailoring it for people's circumstance, whether that be disability or size of families or those kinds of things. I think there are issues around incentives in terms of, you know, if you give people some income, what do you get as a result? Do you get people working or not working or bringing up families or whatever? And there are issues around who pays. I think there's a particular issue as well about borders, you know, in terms of if you set up a particular system with a border, do you get people migrating? But I have to say, you know, in a civilized society, I am ashamed that that many children are growing up in poverty. And long term, I don't think that's good for us as an economy either. And therefore, I think we do have to do something. And so my question is, you know, what do we do to get sufficient? Because at the end of the day, people need money to feed themselves and their children and those kind of things. You know, are we saying we will tolerate people living on less than that? And then finally, people should know the majority of the welfare state goes on pensioners. That is the state in the UK. You know, it's not on the unemployed and the children and the disabled and things. It is pensioners. And that is not a means-tested system. And a lot of those people are perfectly capable of working. But politically, it's unpopular to take it away.
So I guess you have a question about, if not UBI, what else? I actually think that's the kind of question for both sides. So coming through today, I guess the no to UBI, what would your solution be? And then to the UBI side, you know, are you open to kind of other suggestions in this area?
Well, to start with, I mean, to say that if we're against UBI, we're happy for children to continue to live on in poverty or for anybody to live on in poverty, of course that's not the case. I mean, I would be very strongly in favour of reforming the income support system with all that that entails. And I do not think it is a simple matter. And anybody who's looked at social security rules and regulations and how it works and the taper and the conditionality and so on knows that it's an absolute hornet's nest. But it can't be solved by universal basic income, in my view, because the cost is too great. So I would take the money, the extra money we're going to raise from all the things that we ways that we think we can raise extra money, and I would invest in what I would call the social infrastructure of the economy, alongside a more generous system of income support, okay, which would be means tested. But I would invest in childcare and housing and transport and community centres and local skills centres for people who are starting up businesses and support for them and training and schools and healthcare. And all of those things would generate jobs, and that would help more people have an income, and that would create the sense that we're all in this together. We're not just getting money to do what we want with, but we're trying to work together, pooling risks, sharing resources, and helping each other. And that's the way that I would go about it if I were in charge of things.
I wouldn't disagree with any of that. I'd have a caveat, I think, or additional one. So I started my journey today in one of the poorer parts of the rising world, towards the higher index of deprivation, and I ended it walking from Lakesbridge. And it seems to me that when you unite those two places, is the majority of people in them aren't working to get where they are. You don't end up in a BMW X, whatever, in Lakesbridge or Harvey. The state, or in some cases other states, have placed you there, you know, through luck or through the fortune of connections or whatever it is. And quite often, we seem to think that people who are wealthy have become wealthy through work. So it seems to me that whatever system we have, whether it's UBI or anything else, has to break this link between work and being able to live a decent modest like. That it seems to me that particularly since, I mean, I've seen some slides on the upcoming impact of universal credit on children and poverty in Wales, and I think it's bad now given the 2022. You know, it's just so, and it seems to me that the fundamental issue with our welfare system is it pretends there are jobs for everybody, and there will be more jobs to spend money on renewables and green infrastructure. I get all that. But the idea that somebody with serious mental health issues or with serious issues on physical, you know, fitness for work, I think probably you used the term retraining earlier, if you try for decades to retrain people into jobs which notionally are arriving. If we can break the link between people being able to live a decent life and people being expected to find a job which increasingly won't exist, I suspect for many people, I'm happy with whatever comes out of the end.
So, I mean, my first observation is that you're completely right, that we somehow tolerate £100 billion being spent on pensions, and nobody ever quibbles about it at all, and yet spending £100 billion on working-age people and disabled people is the source of extraordinary kind of political upheaval and turmoil and dissent in a way that is uncomfortable and wrong. And why is that? And I think it comes out of a shared belief, which is sort of partially fictional, and that it's earned. And people, you know, I paid my stamps, and therefore they want their rent, they want everything, right? And up to a point, it's partly true, and partly there's kind of complexity around it. And so I think we have to actually ask the question: how do we create a sense that people have earned their entitlement to the working age benefits in a way that is compatible with the vast majority of those claimants who are vulnerable in one way or another? And I don't instantly know what that is, but I think we've already had some good examples around community participation. There's always a question with any kind of conditionality about what do you do about the most vulnerable who can't comply? And what do you do to protect people from destitution and homelessness? It seems to me that a sort of fallback system also needs to exist. But to create a story that is equal to that story of pensions, which sustains this vast and growing burden without any political dissent, we need to find a way to tell a story about the legitimacy of welfare, the legitimacy of mutual support and solidarity. And I think we're only at the beginning of knowing exactly what that is. But then we also need to think about the underpinning drivers of why of poverty, which aren't just are you getting enough money, but also why are you having to spend so much money, in particular on housing. That's less of an issue in Wales, but it's still a problem. We still have rents that are too high, a system of housing that's predicated on this idea where you have to go onto this grotesque thing called the housing ladder, because your housing is not consumption but investment, which is just rotten and wrong. Disability, that there's not enough care, there's not enough support. Those are we know that, you know, more than half of people who are in poverty are disabled in one way or another. And, you know, if you're not tackling the caring needs of those people, you are in ends you're just going to have to sort of prop them up with cash handouts. And that's why I kind of come to Anna's points about investing in the services that improve people's lives, whether that is housing provision, caring, or disability. Actually, the number of people who are just sort of unemployed is incredibly low. And why, my God, we were at like peak employment in our history, and everyone's like, oh yeah, work's about to be abolished. Well, yeah, okay, but you know, almost everybody who can work has a job right now.
Mark, do you think on this question, we'll move on to the next question?
One, I'm glad Polly mentioned Wales, because this is in the Welsh context, and in the Welsh context a lot of the issues are, they can be defined, I think there is a centre of gravity that is different to the rest of the UK, which I think could take some of these things in one direction. I just want to just, 3 years ago my grandmother died. My grandmother was 94, she was ready to die. She had a very short illness, but it was very acute. And there was a point when all her grandchildren and my parents and my uncle were all there with her at one time. And she was as if she was as alive as she's ever been. And the thing that taught me is that it isn't about the money, it's about connections that people make. And without sounding too I think we've probably all agree, but there needs to be a change in what's important to our lives. I've spent the last 8 years in less money than I've ever into my life and never been happier. And it's because I've had purpose in what I've been doing. And it's been remarkable, and it's also bizarrely, perhaps because I could afford it, but it also, I had the opportunity to say what I felt. Because at the moment, people in lots of jobs actually are restricted in ability to say things, to do things. The Welsh public sector, I can't find people who've got a voice anymore because they're all so scared. The two people who've spoken out recently, which you've probably all have seen, Steve Thomas and the Auditor General, Hugh Vaughan Williams, have both said how bad Wales is. But they said it as they're getting their golden handshakes. We need, you know, how do we get people to be more brave? It is because they can say no to people, and at the moment they can't say no. These are things that we need to come to. But you know, in terms of other solutions, I think there are lots of those. I agree with everything you said. We should invest in. I think we should stop commuting. It's a stupidity there. Blokes do it more than women. You know, there's last week there's a Michelin starred restaurant in Montgomeryshire, who gave up their Michelin star because they wanted to stop doing the work that they were doing. Then you read underneath, and it says, and the chef, the husband, is now commuting all across the world, selling his chefing skills because they need that money to survive. So they've got a young family, so he's now disappearing and not being able to stay with his family. These are grotesque decisions that we've been forced to make for the wrong reasons, and I think we can start to break some of that. But that requires a massive change of, you know, not needing the next iPhone 26, because it's the same as the iPhone 2.
Can I start by thanking all the speakers for a very feisty debate and also for the passion with which they've addressed the issues? And I suppose the question is, we've all recognised there's a problem. Is UBI the solution? And I think it's interesting to note that you've mainly focused on the idea of how do you actually extract more money for the tax base, as opposed to should we have a different distribution of income across the spectrum? Because we know that inequality of income has increased over the years. Those Gini coefficient levels have not improved. They've gone the wrong direction. And so we're trying to support a wider and wider number of people from a narrower and narrower tax base. And therefore, that narrow tax base has become more influential as far as government is concerned as to what is acceptable policy and what is not. And what we've also seen, therefore, is that society itself has become somewhat discombobulated. If you look at the spirit level and Pickett and Wilkinson, you can see that actually countries with more equal earnings actually work out better in terms of social outcomes than those with less equal earnings, more or less. But I wonder whether we shouldn't be looking at something more radical, in the sense that what is the cause of all these woes? It is remarkable that we live in a schizophrenic society where for centuries we've battled as democracies for the principle of one person, one vote. But the corporate structure that is true for the vast majority of us, certainly for large companies, is based on the principle of £1, one vote. We have created the single most perfect plutocratic system of governance ever known to mankind. And as companies become bigger and governments become smaller, actually, it is a plutocratic country in which we exist, not a democratic country. And the people who exercise those plutocratic decisions, the management, actually are not in practice accountable to the shareholders. In fact, they're not accountable to anyone. And if you look at, for example, the Persimmon chief executive's pay of over £70 million, he is emblematic of the fact that there's an enormous change in the differential between what the ordinary person earns, never mind the UBIs, the ordinary person earns, and the elite at the top. And that has caused extraordinary problems within our society, which the UBI itself will not solve. And the question I have for you is, do you think that companies should be run across democratic lines? Why should shareholders have votes in companies? Why should employees not have a vote in companies on an annual general meeting basis, in the same way that we as voters elect our governments, and we expect them, perhaps with some not very satisfactory results just at the moment, but we elect governments to take decisions on our behalf. The fact is that CEOs would certainly not have the incomes they have now if the employees could vote on the directors' pay rates at an annual general meeting rather than shareholders with accounting committees. Anyway, that's just a slightly more radical alternative to UBI.
So the question is it about, I guess, pre-distribution, if you like, to some extent, rather than redistribution? Do we need to be reforming capitalism rather than sharing out the proceeds of capitalism in a better way?
Saying what we need is radical change, then yes, we do. And I think we might even all agree on this panel that there's a real problem with the way that capitalism is constructed now and what the effects that it's having and the way that it's working, and that we have to decide actually whether we're going to whether we think we can reform capitalism or whether we think we need to move towards a radical alternative to capitalism, which probably wouldn't have any sense to all have UBI as part of it anyway.
I guess the kind of question here was like, kind of, are we trying to address a problem by UBI that's actually a more fundamental problem with the way the system is working? I think is kind of where your question comes from. So we've had a kind of yes on this side to some extent. I mean, if I may kind of throw back something on this, so you know, one reason I can see why you wouldn't give an employee the kind of same kinds of votes as you would give a shareholder is that, you know, a shareholder, you know, their capital is invested in it. They can lose everything if that business goes under. Whereas they can lose their limited liability. So but they can lose all of the capital that's invested in there. Whereas a labour person can lose any specific human capital that's invested, but, you know, any general human capital, any other thing they've kind of got on the job, they can't lose. So I guess what I was saying there on that is, would you go as far as that kind of fundamental, complete reassessment of kind of capitalism, or do you think it's kind of like, you know, we can just kind of make relatively small changes to kind of the way capitalism is governed?
Well, I mean, cooperatives in general are a compelling model of ownership that potentially reduces or ends the division between labour and capital by making labour and capital the same thing. But there are arguments not just for employee cooperatives, but also for customer cooperatives, you know, or for community cooperatives. The question of who owns these companies is real and important, and who gets to decide on their direction. But you can easily have a small company with 100 very highly paid employees because they've outsourced everybody else, running, I don't know, a huge company like Facebook and making decisions about. And together they decide to keep all the money for themselves and not worry about the kind of customer. So I don't think it's as simple as saying employees are the one group to whom all power should be aggregated. I don't think that's right. I think assuming shareholders get to make all decisions about everything is not correct, but we probably need to be a bit more creative about the different models of cooperation.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on the question?
Well, I mean, obviously, if we go back 400 years, embody the corporation as an individual with similar rights, we would probably be doing well. Maybe that mistake that we made, making business effectively people with no responsibilities, was starting to go wrong. I absolutely take the point about there need to be a far more diverse set of organizational structures. You know, the cooperative model has lots to recommend it. It's got lots to not recommend it as well when it comes to making the quick decisions, you know, and investing power in an executive. That's very different from cooperatives. And cooperatives are often quite inward-looking, you know, in some ways, Basque can't even see that. Absolutely take the point. I think there's a wider problem here, that not only do we have a model of corporate structure which is problematic, but the way in which the deregulation of the UK economy in the 1980s has shown corporates that profits lie in outsourcing, offshoring, focusing on property, growing asset classes and flipping them. That has combined with a problematic kind of model of control,
to give us the worst of several possible rules in the UK, which hasn't happened in some other continental countries.
So, my organisation, we're a cooperative. We have a flat pay structure. We run a 4-day week. We try and tackle some of the issues that you're talking about. I think you're dead right. I think you talked about income inequality. We need to talk about wealth inequality, I think, in the same breath, because I think that's something that we ignore too easily. Does anyone know where Watch It is? Watch It is directly opposite Barry, which is where I'm from. So Watch It is just down from EDF in Key Point. So I went there the other day to talk about setting up a co-working space there, met a lot of people who are working in the third sector. The local councils have all run away without any money, they've all gone bust. And the only people who are now paying, we're talking about the power of corporations, the only people who are paying to sort people's roofs out, if their roof has got a hole in it, are EDF Energy and Hinkley Point. So the challenge for people who may not want nuclear power on their doorstep has been from the organisations who would normally do it, has been taken away because their voice has been taken by the money being provided by the people who are running those organisations. It's scary, and you go to a place like Bridgewater. Bridgewater has seen a massive rise in rents there as a result of having a workforce of blokes coming up and turn up. Massive rise in street prostitution, massive rise in drug use, and massive rises in violence in pubs and things like that. These are the consequences of a corporation that is out of control and can run the state better than these local authorities that have gone best. And the reason they've gone best is because of political decisions that you were in those rooms for.
Ooh, well, we can maybe have a conversation about that over drinks later. But I think another question.
Thank you. My name's Jane Dodds and I am the leader of the Welsh Liberal Democrats. I live in a very rural area in Montgomeryshire, actually. And what I'm about to say is not about the position of the Welsh Liberal Democrats. They're very, very personal views. I've been a very big advocate of UBI. I'll state that very clearly. My background is all in social work. So I've worked with families who literally have nothing. And the stress on those families when they don't know where their next meal or whatever is coming from is major. And it is major for their societies and communities. But what I really want to think about with you is, do you feel that the concept of UBI and trialling UBI could also be linked with us looking at how we could measure the way we are looking at our society? So I'm really sad to hear you talk about the monetary aspects and how we look at our society from a very, you know, a monetary GDP is the measurement point and tax revenues, etc. Is there an argument to be made that we look at it differently, that we look at mental health, that we look at educational achievements, that we look at reduction in stress? And that could be a link to actually changing the arguments around thinking about a universal basic income.
Yeah, so I guess the kind of question is around is should we, you know, when thinking about what we're measuring, I guess, in terms of, like, you know, success, is success more than just GDP? Is it around other things? And can that kind of make the case in, like, UBI a bit stronger?
Well, my organisation has led the charge to try and have well-being as a measure of national success rather than just GDP. It's a critique of using GDP as a measure of success. So I certainly would welcome and encourage all efforts we can all make to get people to wake up and understand that GDP is not a measure of success. It's a very poor measure. But I want to come back to the thing you said at the beginning. You said you work with people who have nothing. But none of us would surely disagree that there should be a more generous income support, social security, social protection, whatever you call it, system for people who have nothing and for people who have a little bit and for people who have even a little bit more than that. But the question is the answer, if the problem that you are concerned with is the problem of people who have nothing and the levels of poverty in Wales and inequality in Wales, I just cannot see how UBI is the answer. Yes, an improved, more generous social security system. Yes, less means testing. Yes, more generous child benefit, for example. I mean, I'm a bit confused about how Wales is going to find its own funds to transform the social security system, but that perhaps is something that needs to come, but not through UBI, which is just a cash distribution system. What you want to be doing is you want to be investing in your own social infrastructure, and that's what I think you should be supporting.
And I completely endorse the work of NEF on well-being measures, and you know, there's some now measured by the ONS. All of that's incredibly important. I will stop caring about tax revenue the day teachers and nurses and social workers stop asking for wages, right? We have to care about the amount of money that comes through the door of the Treasury and is given to people. Otherwise, you know, I mean, unless you want to get into modern monetary theory, and I really don't.
I was tempted then, but the point of the taxes don't fund spending, but that's pretty far state of spending. We're all going to tie it, aren't we?
I agree with you.
Yeah,
okay, I've chance for one more question at the back here. If it's a quick one, we can maybe do another one.
Very brief question. Two. I'm not an economist, but I'd like to know, why is Wales such a poor region in the European community? And secondly, why don't we execute on means test? Those who can afford to do without social security or without a state pension, why don't we execute a policy that says you have enough assets, you don't need these state pension?
So, two quite different questions there. I mean, I guess if we can kind of deal with the first one first, sorry, the second one first, and then come back to the first one if you have any thoughts there. So, why don't we means test more benefits that are currently, I guess, contributory universe, like the state pension or window fuel payments? Is it political? Is it actually because
window fuel payments, of course, we should means test, and pensions, there's just a really important argument, which is about encouraging people to save, and at the core of that is about having a non-means-tested system. Otherwise, most people are saving for no reason at all, and culturally we don't save enough. But, the bus pass and the window fuel payment and all of that is just silly. TV license.
The bus pass is very good because it encourages people to use public transport instead of getting into cars.
Pay for the
whatever.
Buses.
And,
everyone should get it.
I think everyone should get it. I do. I mean, that's what I would go for, you see. I give everybody a free bus pass rather than a UBI.
Well,
they're going to spend
the money
on that.
More 50p, you know, like dead cheap, small payment, something like that. Anyway, but whatever.
But then more buses.
Come back to the question. So should we do more means testing of kind of like benefits that currently kind of go to affluent people, or is it part of the social contract, or is it part of the incentive mechanism that we kind of do give some benefits to people that have?
Well, if you're a rich pensioner, you pay tax on your other income, taking account of what your pension is. So they do claw some of it back. I think I don't think I would means test the state pension. If it's contributory, no. I mean, and the pension credit is means tested anyway. So I wouldn't go down that road at all. I think, I would recommend the sort of approach that was, I think, really well ably sketched out, and there's only really a sketch at this stage, by the Fabian Society working with another organisation, I forget which one it is, that came up with a sort of four-tiered way of reforming the income support system. I didn't have to play any part of this. I looked at it, I thought it seems to include most of the things. We do have a universal, sort of an unconditional element, which would be things like child benefit and pensions. You include a means-tested benefit. And then there were a couple of other things, I can't remember what they were now, but the point is, it's complicated. And there is not a single sort of silver bullet answer to the problems of social security reform, which is the danger in the claim for universal basic income. Oh yeah, it's really rubbish, the system we've got now. Let's just do universal basic income and then everything will be right. No, it won't. And it just sets all these other difficulties running, like there's no money to pay for green infrastructure, there's no money to pay for the NHS, there's no money to pay for anything else. However much money we raise, it will be very, very expensive.
Can I start by blowing a myth at that you? So you said that we are poor, Wales is poor. So Wales is income poor. But Resolution Foundation did some work that looked at the average family, I'm to read it, because it's average family total net wealth per adult
by region or country. The top of the southeast, then the southwest, then the east, then Wales. So we're not the poorest. We're about the medium of everyone. But our wealth is in property. We own a lot of our properties. It's about tax. That wealth does nothing to help it's useless wealth. So if we wanted to, we can take a choice and make some of those sort of decisions. We talk down Wales. It's very easy to talk down Wales on an income perspective. It's very I hear very few people talking about this, and I wonder why. Because I think that's where the opportunity lies.
I'll be really brief on the set. I'm not going to address the second question. The first question: Why is Wales poor? I've written hundreds of thousands of words on this. I'll give you a couple of sentences. The best indicative kind of fact I can give you is that, you know, we lose 25% of our graduates every, the cream of the crop to England every year, right? Rich places keep poor places poor. And what do we get back? Grumpy old English men, largely, who then have lots of other dysfunctioning patterns. And for better or worse, I think in the Welsh case, we don't control many of the levers that we have, and until we do, until, you know, I mean, luckily with Brexit, we may see kind of, you know, rebalancing, things like this poorer. But we, you know, it's very difficult for little colonies to break free. Ireland's just about done it in the last 100 years. And lots of the kind of dysfunctional, all roads lead to London, you know, the spending of the UK government is massive in the Golden Triangle, that kind of stuff. It's a problem for the North East, it's a problem for Wales. Scotland has it easier because Scotland's a federal threat to leave, and we don't. And if I put in a nutshell, that's the slightly contentious problem.
So fundamentally, we should close down Wales and London and replace it with London and Wales.
I would be delighted to host it. Delighted to have you.
Okay. I think actually we need to call it to a close this. So if there's any more questions, kind of approach people kind of in the drinks afterwards. I just wanted to kind of wrap up what I think, you know, actually has been a debate that's gone off in many different directions. So it's quite challenging to kind of think about, you know, where we've come to in terms of any kind of consensus and disagreements. But I want to try. So I think where we have come to agreement amongst the panel at least here is that, you know, the current system isn't working. Whether that is the current system of how business is working, how the economy is working, you know, underlying, you know, what the government does, and then what the government is doing on top of that in terms of, you know, the benefit system, whether it's generous enough, whether it is, you know, putting people through too many hoops, whether it is, you know, too stringent. There seems to be agreement, I think, on the panel on those kind of issues. Now, where there doesn't seem to be agreement is whether the idea of UBI is kind of worthwhile looking at in this context. I think those against UBI are very strongly against it. Those in favour of UBI seem to think it's something worth thinking about, but are open to other suggestions as well. So, I mean, that leads me to think, you know, is this actually, you know, an issue about, you know, UBI being an option going forwards, or is it actually using the debate about UBI to open up a debate more broadly about what our system of tax benefit and public services should be doing for different kinds of people? And that debate shouldn't just be about universality versus, you know, not universal. But I think we need to kind of think about roles like, you know, what is the role of contributoriness in the benefit system? How much is it about, you know, what you put in has a relation to what you get out? What are the kind of role of conditions? You know, I think, you know, in your talk, you talked about, you know, people want to, you know, people are paying their hard-earned tax. They want to feel that there's some kind of social contract. They're not just kind of handing that over and having nothing in return. What is the role of conditionality? What are the acceptable types of conditions on there? So maybe this debate about UBI.
It's good about services. Sorry.
I did mention public services as well. Okay, public services as well. What is the role of public services in this versus what is the role of, you know, giving people income to do things themselves? So maybe this kind of debate about UBI, maybe UBI, you know, I'm not sure these guys would quite agree with this, but maybe UBI is itself a bit of a distraction, but the debate it's generating is not a distraction. It's a debate we should be having, we need to have, and that's the good thing that's coming out of this discussion. So, I mean, that's my takeaway there, that actually this debate about UBI, even if it's not the right solution, it's making us think, what the right solutions could be as our, you know, economy's currently not working, and as further problems could be developing over time with things like automation, with things like rising capital shares, etc. So maybe it's opening a debate we need to be having.